Hello, everybody. I'm sorry for the delay in the episode coming out. I've been on the road for about 10 days. The NARSOC conference always wipes me out. I recently bought a snazzy portable recorder, and while at the hotel at the conference, I found some folks sitting around a table in the restaurant. I put it on the table, and off we went. The reason why I'm telling you this is because the quality isn't stellar. There's some background noise that I've tried to remove, but of course, it's a hotel restaurant. There's only so much I can do. Without further ado, I hope you enjoy it.
Good evening, Larry.
Hi, Andy.
So here we are at the Independence, where are we at?
Crown Plaza?
Crown Plaza in Ohio at the NARSOC conference. Joining me, obviously, is Larry. And we have Paul Dubling, Richard Mori, and Brenda Jones. And we're going to just have a quick little roundtable conversation about the conference and wherever the conversation goes. Some of us are drinking, some of us are not, so I don't know where this is going to go. Who wants to start?
I think that by the virtue of the hierarchy, that the executive director should talk about the conference.
Excellent. Brenda, tell us about the conference.
Well, we're wrapping it up. We've had all kinds of wonderful guests on the program, and attorneys and lawmakers. I know one of the highlights of it was we actually had a mock legislative hearing with legislators leading the hearing, and it was just so realistic for those of us who've done it, and I think eye-opening for those who didn't, to just see how one of these things goes, and just a whole lot of good stuff. I was interested, though. We were just... Just before we began this, we were sitting around the table talking about the kind of people who show up at these. The demographics are, I'd say we had a good third of the folks here are local. They're all from Ohio and immediate environs. And the rest scattered all across the country from California to Maine and down to Florida. So we've definitely coast to coast. But the other demographic is we were noticing how many family members were showing up, and because of discovering a loved one, you know, having gotten a conviction, it's like, what? There's this registry? What's that all about? Oh my God, you got to be kidding me! And having to learn firsthand, you know, what these laws are about. So we were just getting started with that, and I'd love to just dive on into it.
Certainly.
If I could add, though, the Richard? Other thing that I think is really interesting is we have not a big group, but a nice little group of young persons here in their 20s and early 30s.
We do have younger people.
And that, I think, is exciting.
We've tended to have a somewhat graying crowd, and it has been, and somebody commented on it, where are all the young people last year, I remember. I have seen a lot more in the 20s and 30s this year, so that's been nice too.
Paul, had you gotten here? What, did you see the mock testimony?
I did not.
Okay.
But to Brenda's point, I think that the registry is interesting in that I think a lot of people who end up on the registry come from backgrounds where it was very unexpected that they would ever intersect with the criminal justice system. And there was an expectation that if they ever did, that would be smoothed out somehow, or that the consequences could be minimized. But one of the aspects of the registry that's very unusual is its blanket application and the severity of that application. And so I've met a number of people that have found themselves interacting in ways they never thought they would with what are essentially criminal laws. We can argue ad infinitum about civil versus punitive, but... And for the first time, really become shocked as they start to learn how these things actually work. And I've had several interesting conversations here with people that, you know, basically say, I didn't really have much involvement until I learned what was going on.
That would also extend to politics, as far as how this stuff plays out and who we vote for and how the whole legislative process works. So many of us just kind of stand by on the sidelines and let stuff go and say, we can't do anything about it. But now this hits home so hard, and we try and, you know, many of us try and figure out a way to get involved and make some sort of change.
I think, though, that there may be some possibilities to harnessing that, because what you've also got is a population of people that, that perhaps wouldn't be involved, or certainly wouldn't be involved on this side of these issues, that may have the ear of legislatures or be able to bring a perspective to legislative hearings that hasn't really been heard from before.
So Larry, what are your initial thoughts of the conference so far?
It's been a stellar conference as far as I'm concerned. It's unprecedented to have the senators, bipartisan representation. Kudos to our Ohio people for making that happen. And we had a former elected attorney general, and that's unprecedented. And the attorney general acknowledged that he was wrong and for pushing for the Ohio to be the first state to comply. And he explained the reasons why, and being that I'm a political junkie, I understood it exactly where he was coming from and why. I think some of our people were, their eyes were rolling. They couldn't understand why you would do something that you don't believe in. But a lot of people did understand, and they were very forgiving and appreciative of him saying, I was wrong, that this was misguided, and I should have stood by my principles, but I had a bigger agenda. And the agenda, he explained, is that he was perceived as being a very liberal and a very moderate tilting conservative state, and he had managed to get himself elected largely because he was liked, and he wanted to pursue policies that were dear to him, such as predatory lending, payday loans, as he referred to it. And he found himself in a dominated by conservative Republican legislature who didn't want to fund government because of the anti-tax climate, and this represented an opportunity for free money from the federal government because there were early compliance bonuses afforded to the states who could implement it in a short period of time. And I forget that period of time, but he explained his motivations, and he wanted to also strengthen his conservative credentials because in this moderate to conservative leaning state that he wanted to have a chance to remain in office so he could do the things that were dear to him. So he was willing to go along with this regimen that's recommended from our friends in Congress, and he said in hindsight he was wrong, and that was so impressive for that acknowledgement.
Well, if I could just add to what Larry's saying, and he's 100% right, with the exception that he not just said I was wrong, he did what has never been done. Nobody in the room has ever heard these words: I apologize. And that, I think, was the overwhelming statement.
That was definitely huge for our, because when you opened up for questions, the other thing that happened was so many people, they had very good questions, but more than half of them that got up, they started by saying, I just want to thank you for that apology.
And somebody then asked if he was going to then
help turn the clock backwards
to push back against
it. And I even caught, there was one person in particular that we were concerned about that was coming that we knew, we were concerned might have it in for this guy because he helped pass this act in the first place, right? And when the first person stood up and said, thank you, I looked back, and he was back there just clapping with all the rest of them. And he asked a good question.
And I would add, I talked with him, Mark, afterwards, and he acknowledged that his help, he had acknowledged in front of the group, he's already doing that. He's already working. And he works with the Ohio people and Connie, who's a paid
lobbyist.
But he's, the conversation I had with him was specifically, he says, will you help recruit some of those other persons who also helped at that time to pass that legislation, who may share your same sentiments? And he said yes.
Mm-hmm. He's working on it. So that was cool.
So in the overall conference, I've been to the seventh one, and they get better all the time. The quality of this program, even though I'm on the planning committee, it's a gigantic team effort. No one person can put together such an event, and these troopers get better every time we do one. And any problems we've had have been minimal compared to the success of the quality of the program we've had.
Paul, you're doing a presentation tomorrow. What's the subject?
Well, the way it's played out is I sat down and wrote it today.
Well, let's see, what's the subject? See, I was trying to give you a way out.
So the subject is, the title is Pressure Points, What's Likely to Work and Why. And what I want to talk about is something I touched on last year, but I think is still valid, I want to expand on, and that's the legal and human environment that litigation takes place in. I spoke before about how there's a certain reality that we live in. And for instance, we don't live in a world where the Supreme Court of the United States is going to decide that the Constitution embodies in its interstices a right of privacy, and therefore there is some unenumerated right to the privacy of information for registrants. That's just not going to happen. And I want to talk about where that comes from, why that is, and from those factors, what I call the legal environment, discern what can we take from that that's positive. How can that reality structure positive litigation that's likely to help advance the goals of the organization?
You had said yesterday at one of the region meetings about that there's no right to housing. Did I catch you saying you don't have a right? The tenth city in Florida, it's a travesty that it's happening, but we don't have a right to housing.
Well, I think we want to be very
constitutional, yeah,
right? And I think that's the thing. We want to be very careful about what we're saying,
right?
Particularly if you ask, one of the ways to describe the difference between a conservative and a liberal jurist is the degree to which that jurist believes that the Constitution generally embodies evolving standards of human rights, versus the Constitution is a historical document and any attempt to infuse it with additional meaning is illegitimate. And there are arguments on both sides of that.
Certainly.
But housing's probably a really good example. In the last generation, I think there's been a growing consensus among human rights activists that the right to housing, the right to medical care, the right to a decent wage are sort of fundamental aspects of being a member of a civilized society. And that without them, you can't really say that this society is performing its function.
Agreed.
They are human rights.
Certainly.
But that's a very different question on whether they're constitutional rights.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And one of the things I'm going to talk about tomorrow is, listen, if you're in litigation on these issues, someone who believes, a jurist who believes that the Constitution is more directly correlated with those evolving notions of human rights and not strictly constitutional, they're already on your side. You're already going to win, for lack of a better word, with those. What you need to be thinking about in litigation is how is your argument structured for the person who doesn't think that way, who looks at the Constitution and is thinking to themselves as they're listening to you talk, that's all well and good and you may even be right, but show me in the Constitution where it says you have a right to X.
Right.
And so when I say there's no right to housing, I mean that there is no language in the Constitution that can reasonably be construed as granting a right to housing.
And someone then interjected back, said, well, what about the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness?
I was just going to ask you that.
Which is not part of the Constitution.
It's not part of the Constitution.
Exactly.
It's the
Declaration of Independence,
right? Yeah.
So this is just a doctrine that says, hey, we don't want to deal with you guys anymore, the Declaration of Independence, but it's just a separating way.
It is not the contract between the states and arguably the social contract upon which the United States is founded.
Do you think that there's a place to say that even though it's not enumerated in the Constitution, that there was, hey, this is just the baseline standard that we're going to move forward from here, meaning like housing or things of that nature? I know the thing was written 250 years ago.
This is one of the great debates in jurisprudence. Arguably, if you look at the text of the Constitution, it says Congress shall pass no law. It doesn't say anything about a state shall pass no law.
Okay.
It just doesn't. After the passage of the 14th Amendment, if you look at the text of the 14th Amendment, it does say no state shall, right? The 14th Amendment is where the Constitution jumps textually from a limitation on federal power to a limitation on state power. The 14th Amendment, of course, is the amendment that, one of the amendments that's enacted after slavery, and arguably is about the granting of equal citizenship rights to former slaves and other, what we would call today, people of color. In the 20th century, the idea that the Constitution embodies a more generalized sense of what it means to be human took hold. And liberal jurisprudence of the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and 70s used the 14th Amendment, the provision, no state shall deprive anyone of liberty without due process of law, to be the textual hook, if you will, for saying, well, there are some things that no government can do legitimately. They can't abridge human rights. And so over the course of the 20th century, the amendments to the Constitution, the First Amendment rights, for instance, the freedom of speech, which originally applied only to Congress. There was no guaranteed right to freedom of speech from the state under the federal Constitution. The court began to incorporate these amendments to say that the 14th Amendment means that a state can't abridge the freedom of speech. The 14th Amendment means that a state can't abridge the right to peaceably assemble. The 14th Amendment means a state can't conduct an unreasonable search and seizure. That has been largely accepted as correct in some meaningful sense, but I would point out that those are judicial moves. That's not the text of the Constitution in any real meaningful sense. And in the 60s and 70s, and we could argue about the exact times, but that's where you started to see the court moving even from we're incorporating these limitations on federal governments against the states to saying that this text, no state shall deprive a person of liberty without due process of law, means that they can't take away a person's liberty more broadly defined, and began to say that liberty means, well, classically, the right to an abortion, the right to contraception. These are the seminal cases on this. And I don't think it's an accident that these moves are made in the 60s and early 70s, and the mid-70s is where the court begins to take a distinct rightward turn. It's a generational cycle. The court that gave you Plessy versus Ferguson in the early 20th century and Lochner in the 30s is replaced by what we would call today a progressive court in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, which arguably, and being a political liberal but having a lot of experience with conservative jurisprudence, I think it is certainly fair to argue that the Warren and then Berger courts went too far. They really departed from the text of the Constitution. And the Rehnquist court through today has really been, to some extent, a backlash against that, has been an attempt to cabin that move to allow the Constitution to get away from its textual underpinnings.
So if I can just frame the question, because we're just having a conversation. You've taken us through constitutional law from 1787 through 1792 to the Civil War and into the 1960s and 70s. But isn't there, to back up a second, to go into British law for a minute, the Magna Carta, a series of legal documents between the kings and the lords, those were contracts. So in fact, our Constitution, in essence, is a contract. Is that agreeable? No? It's a contract between a government and its people. I mean, isn't one of the first lines in the Constitution, we the people?
I think being a lawyer, I'm uncomfortable with saying it is a contract and all the freight that implies. I think what it originally is an agreement between states that saw themselves as fundamentally sovereign to join together and submit to a joint sovereignty for very limited purposes that they saw as mutually beneficial. And the idea that the Constitution is a document that guarantees individual liberties is relatively recent. I would point out that I believe it's Maryland had a state religion until 1836.
I want to say that many of them had state religions. They were at least founded under a religious kind of umbrella, Pennsylvania being like Amish territory and so forth. Obviously, the Mormons moving out to Utah.
Rhode Island would have probably been.
Right. But I believe even the idea that the government should be disassociated from religion was not prevalent at the signing of the Constitution, as evidenced by the fact that many state governments were very entrenched
right.
with different forms of religion. And again, I don't know this is true, but I believe Maryland had an official state religion until a generation after the Constitution was signed.
Well, so kind of where I was wondering about, I tend to view the Constitution as a contract, whether it's a legal contract in the corporate sense of the word. I still think we're defining a relationship. That, to me, would be a marriage. It's a contract.
I think it's absolutely fair to say that it defines a relationship.
Okay. So how about the other documents that precede the Constitution? We've got the Declaration of Independence. We've got... what came after the...
You have, like, the Federalist Papers and things like that, right?
The Articles of Confederation.
Articles of Confederation, Bill of Rights. Aren't those also part of that relationship building that was going on at that time?
Are you asking me whether, because they're signs of other conversations and agreements, they're right. properly sort of incorporated in determining Constitution
means? Well, and also determining what individual rights might be.
Oh, so the fact that we mentioned at the first part, like life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness,
right.
is that, could that still be considered a fundamental right, even if it's not a constitutional right, just because our founding fathers said it?
I would go back to my first observation, which is the Constitution in its original form really has nothing to do with the preservation of individual liberties.
Individual.
It's a power-sharing arrangement between the states and the newly created
the
federal government.
The thing you said started coming in after the 14th Amendment.
Right, and the Bill of Rights is added to the original Constitution to set specific limits on federal power, which I think it's interesting because as soon as there was a federal government, the states began worrying that it would overstep itself and begin trying to impose things from on high. But the idea that the Constitution is a document that itself protects individual liberties. Well, the origin of the idea I don't know, but the prevalent view that it does is certainly a post Civil War view, and it's not until the 20th century, even the mid 20th century, that's widely accepted as the fundamental purpose of the Constitution.
Going back to what you said about the states being sovereign, that leads you right into the 10th Amendment, which is that the federal government shall have no power that which the states do not give it, setting up a fundamental structure that the states are driving what the federal government is allowed to do.
Correct, absolutely.
So we are 50 individual countries plus D.C.
Well, that was the original intent.
Right.
So, and I would say that I don't know the ultimate answer, but there is a powerful argument that the basic structure of the United States, the current reach of the federal government, is greatly at odds with the foundational understanding of the relationship. I think today most people think of the United States as the predominant sovereign.
Agreed.
In some meaningful sense.
I completely agree with you.
And that is not a view
right.
that existed in much at all before the Civil War. And I would say not a view that was prevalent until much more recent than we might think.
Not that I want to refight this, but the Civil War itself was in part that conversation. States' rights versus federal rights.
Well, yeah, it's not part of the conversation anyway.
Yes, yeah. States' rights to do something.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had that argument with a bunch of people that say, "Yeah, it was about states' rights." Yes, states' rights to do. Come on, finish the sentence. Well, states' rights to own other people as property. No. It was about states' rights. Yes, states' rights to do what? Anyway.
Yeah. One of the things that to kind of bring that around that I think happens at every conference and all times during is an education of these new people that come on board because, they're just finding out. As I mentioned, there's a lot of family members, and frequently it's their first encounter with all of these issues. And they come on board, and they're shocked to find out this kind of thing. there, and one of the things that almost always immediately happens, and I see it on our Facebook all the time, is every time we post something that shows just the god-awful reach, you know, or the overreach or whatever, there's abolish the registry, abolish the registry. And of course they're talking about Adam Walsh and SORNA and the national government. And so, you know, clearly if we could just tell President Trump or Congress or whatever that they should make the registry go away, or if the Supreme Court would just get off their butts, like there's no case that has to be taken up there, if they would just do the right thing and make the registry go away, everybody would be happy ever after. And they are very disappointed to find out when they get here that we're talking about, as one person remarked, eating an elephant one bite at a time, which was a reference from our Friday morning. And what do you mean we can't make the registry go away? What do you mean if the registry goes away at the national level, there's still registries in all 50 states? Huh? And it's very discouraging to these people. And, you know, we're all getting excited by the little bites we take out of our elephant. Well, they're going, oh, my God.
I think something that I find fascinating is when I tell them, which makes me unpopular, that you voted for this stuff.
Yeah.
And it drives them up the wall. But I tell them that if you'll just think back and be intellectually honest with yourself, most of you, when someone says, how do you feel about the laws, should we toughen them about sexual exploitation of children? Of course, a child can be, in most broad definition, anyone under one day under 18 years of age, which is the age of majority, I think, in all of our states. And I tell them, well, when candidates were campaigning, they said we want to be tough on people who exploit children. Did you say hip hip hooray, or did you say hell no? And they all say that they said hip hip hooray. And I said, well then why are you surprised that we have tough laws on people who commit crimes against minors or children, or however you want to categorize that group of people, when you were for it until now? And then they look at me and roll their eyes and say, but it was for the child molesters. I said, well, what do you think the average person thinks of someone who's 22 years old that has sex with a 14-year-old? A 14-year-old is a child. And a 22-year-old is an adult. That's the traditional college graduation age. So you are, in fact, a child molester in the literal terms. And therefore, you were for being vicious with these people who exploit children until it happened to you.
But that's not my kid. My kid did something different.
They say that.
It was consensual with them.
And I said, but still, they're not allowed under the law to give consent. And you were for that until this happened to you. And we have to have that honest discussion, because until you can come to grips with the fact that you were for it, it's not justified for you to be mad at your neighbor when they're for what you were for until it happened to you. And they leave some saying, thank you for the clarification. And of course, yeah. I know what they say. I don't have any idea what they say.
You know, and we're laughing, but it's, you know, we're laughing because we're in the middle of this advocacy thing. But you're not really laughing when you're sitting there facing a mom or a dad and their kid maybe either just went off to prison or they just got out of prison. And they're busy just full of tears, you know, because my son's life is over and you're telling me, you know, and so you can't sit there and laugh at them. So if anybody's listening to this podcast eventually, you know, we're not laughing at you. It's just so difficult. And so you laugh so you don't cry, right?
It highlights the point, right? Which is that my position is we live in a conservative legal world, and that is not going to change for a generation.
Yeah.
But that tells us a couple things. It tells us that there's room in today's world to argue that states really have the authority. And if the federal government starts to try to mandate registries, starts to itself try to direct premises restrictions, internet restrictions, housing restrictions, there are arguments that can be made from the conservative standpoint that I think have a high chance of being successful, that that's overstepping federal bounds. It also tells us that this is very much a political issue. Litigation can achieve results. It can cabin the legislature's power, particularly the federal government's power. But ultimately, I would tell people in that position that energy can be directed. And ultimately, registries are creatures of the state. You know, in one sense, if there were no state registry in my state, the existence of a national registry, which at this point is really nothing more than an aggregation of the state registry, would really cease to matter in a lot of the ways that it matters very much to people today. So the upside of all of this is that states matter, that this is a result of politics happening on a level small enough that individuals can actually make a difference. And that's what I ultimately encourage people to do. As I've said before, my role as an attorney is to take bites out of the elephant. But if you fundamentally want to change the nature of what's going on, that energy, that newfound advocacy needs to be directed. And the good news is it needs to be directed at state houses. You don't need the Congress of the United States to take action. You just need them to stop acting.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
A question that I have for mostly the two of you, for Larry and Paul, is that it seems that, it feels to me that because we have a very limited number of people in our states doing anything, that we're losing by default. The bill comes up, there's no one on our side opposing a bad bill or promoting something that would be in our favor, that we just lose because we're not there. And it would be really low-hanging fruit to get someone ineffective in there to snatch that low-hanging fruit, kind of sort of anybody showing up. And maybe.
There are stories, and I'm not going to remember exactly where one person who stepped forward actually stopped some of those things.
I can name you two of them right off the bat.
Well, there are real stories where one person made the difference of stopping some of that kind of
just because she got there.
Larry?
I agree. It doesn't require an army of people. It requires relationships, knowledge and understanding and respect for the process, and diligence to follow up. You may have to show up at your, this is not a one-time thing where you show up at the Capitol one day and you take one day off work and you go in and you accomplish something. And that's what people, we're an instant gratification society. Everything, whether it be the war in Iraq, we want instant gratification. And this is a prolonged battle with victories, losses, regrouping, and people can make a difference, but they have to persevere, and they're looking for the silver bullet. But yes, one person doing the right things in my state, that's largely what it is, one or two people that are holding back the floodgates of bad legislation. And we're on defense, and we'll be on defense for some time, as Paul said, because not only are we in a conservative litigating environment, we're largely throughout the country in a conservative political environment, which lends itself towards being tougher and tougher on people who've been convicted of crimes and the regulatory schemes like the registry. And although they profess allegiance to small government, they are great at expanding the reach of prisons, probation, parole, GPS monitoring, urine testing. You go on and on with things that they are in favor of that cost money.
Larry, I can see the number of listeners going down as you're talking. Paul, what do you think? Nothing?
About
that we're losing by default, that we don't have anybody representing our side of the issue, pro or con, depending on which side of the bill is on, that we're just losing by default. not everywhere. There are places that are doing great work, Ohio being a case, but you know, maybe Georgia, for example, or some, you know, Alabama doesn't have any representation there.
And not to be flip, but I think if there's no one in the room, then you can't expect your position to hold sway.
Absolutely.
That's a nice way to put it. When these processes are taking place and these committees are hearing the referred bills that are being promoted by law enforcement and victims advocates, when they call for public testimony, and there's various ways that they do it across the country in terms of public testimony, it may be by registration, it may be by some process that's less open than others, but if there's no one there participating in that process, by however they take public input, in some cases it may be written testimony or a combination, if there's nobody there, then they only have the expertise of the people who are promoting the legislation, which is the victims groups, the Me Too movement now, and
the Sheriff's Association, the
law enforcement apparatus, and the we can call the prison industrial complex as well represented.
Mm-hmm.
The people who have apparatuses to sell to the states and to the governmental entities that cost money and yield a continuous flow of revenue.
Yep. The examples that Richard and I were thinking of, what Larry was describing is, of course, the long-term solution, which is to build your relationships with lawmakers, to, you know, show up regularly, to become that go-to person. But there are also, like I say, at least two instances I can name where simply showing up, even if your testimony isn't all that great because you don't have a clue what you're up to. The first year we showed up in Maryland, just being there was such a shock to everybody. They'd been passing this legislation, you know, right and left, and suddenly we're dropping off these things that were against these bills, and they're going, huh? And people were, and those folks who were going, doesn't anybody care about this? We're going, hey, somebody cares about this. I mean, it made an impact. And we, at the very least, I know that particular year, we stopped residency restrictions. They've never come back. There's maybe a more dramatic instance in Kentucky, where one person who found out about they were trying to implement, I think, Adam Walsh or something close to it, found out, did the research, figured she'd never been there before, figured out what she had to do, wrote up her little testimony, showed up, you know, and made, she's doesn't even like public speaking, but she showed up and made an impression. They asked her questions, they brought her back, and it died. You know, one person showing up where nobody's shown up before. So, I mean, that's maybe the most dramatic instance. It's not always that common, but literally, just go, just be there, find out how to do it, and then just be there.
Paul?
I think this is another place where, for local affiliates, building relationships with attorneys can help. My experience has been that by being involved in litigation on this issue, I've come into contact with and come to know several of the district attorneys in North Carolina, some of whom are on the state legislature, which has given me at various times a platform to speak to the Judiciary Committee and explain the legal issues that are involved. And I'm not a big fan necessarily of going in with only a big stick, but it is powerful, and I have had success in some instances by pointing out to a legislator or a district attorney that we could either let this die quietly or there could be a constitutional lawsuit. And I find that oftentimes my client will achieve success for themselves simply because the state does not want to engage in prolonged litigation for the purpose of keeping one person on the registry, or enacting a bill that they're not really convinced is going to have a positive effect, but they feel like they might get otherwise some positive benefit from. There are sticks that as a lawyer we have, even in this environment, and sometimes it's enough just to say, this will be a fight, and is it worth fighting about? Mm-hmm. And surprisingly often the answer is no.
Can we move over to Packingham for a minute? The internet is near and dear to my heart. And I don't think that anybody on the registry or not would ever be denied telephone service or electrical or water service or gas service. The whole, I guess, Title II, I might be getting that wrong, where they could possibly classify the internet as a utility, thus making it that everyone has effectively a right to have internet access, there's a huge disadvantage to people to not having it, whether that be any kind of research, job applications, banking, paying bills, etc. Do you see that making any sort of move as to becoming something that is universally accepted as a thing?
Well, I think in that respect, the Packingham decision was actually very powerful. The Supreme Court has been getting younger over the past generation as different political parties have figured out
that Gorsuch is in his late 40s, right?
If you start in your 40s, you've got a long time. If you start in your 60s, you've got 20 years left.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court has often been, and often fairly, accused of not really understanding what's going on, particularly when it comes to technology.
Yeah.
But in Packingham, the court did understand clearly that the internet is speech, and that denial of that speech forum is meaningful. They recognize to a large extent that most people use the internet in their day-to-day lives, and the denial of that use is a severe detriment to their ability to communicate. And
where does that cross the line of being something of denying somebody a constitutional right to function?
Speech.
Literally just speech. Does that encompass where it says go to bkjobs.com to fill out an application?
If that's
that is technically then speech?
Yes. Speech is the right to speak. It's the right to receive information. The court's been very clear that it's both. And surprisingly, perhaps, speech, the court has generally, throughout the 20th century, recognized that it's a fairly broad-based concept. It's not just the ability to say what you want, which is what it's typically said, but it's the right to receive information. It's arguably tied up with the right to receive an education. It's the right to have access to the modes of speech, which is really what the internet cases are about,
okay.
Right?
Okay.
That if I am denying you fundamentally the ability to use the primary mode by which I communicate with others, I am effectively denying you the right to broadcast your message. And the internet doesn't have the countervailing concerns that the public airwaves might. You know, if I own a means of transmission, then I have property rights, which, you know, may give me the right not to give you particular access to that. But the internet is a public megaphone.
It is, but it is still a point-to-point communication mechanism, whereas if, you know, you stand up a 50,000-watt tower and everyone hears it, but the internet is one-to-one across billions of people.
What do you mean by one-to-one?
Well, like the actual architecture, when someone goes to download this podcast, when your software says, I want it, you will contact my server and you will receive it on a one-to-one basis. When his system goes and does it, he has a one-on-one conversation with my machine.
I would look more at the example of you post something to Facebook.
Right.
And you post it publicly.
Mm-hmm.
In one sense, that's one-to-one communication. But in the same sense that television is one-to-one communication, if you consider that I have to tune in.
I completely understand where you're going with yes. I'm considering the communications of being between the person and Facebook, not the people that are attached to Facebook to receive it.
And I'm honestly asking you what the distinction is between that and saying I am broadcasting a television program. I am uploading it to the satellite, which will then broadcast it.
A newspaper.
But a newspaper would be more of a one-to-one because you actually have to make an action to receive. Granted, turning on a television or a radio would be an action to receive it. But those things are being pelted at you constantly 24 hours a day, the radio signals, being different. Whereas a newspaper or the internet, you have to actually take an active engagement activity to make it happen. Similar to electricity.
You have to log on to Facebook. You'd have to subscribe to the newspaper. Is that the kind of distinction
I'm making a comparison there of being similar.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the newspaper could be out there. The news is out there. But you have to make an actual engaged activity to receive it, to actually collect that. Where the airwaves, it's just happening all the time.
But why would that make it?
Yeah, what's
different?
The difference?
Well, I'm not...
constitutional...
I don't have a different... But you can... you know, we talk about all the time of Rush saying he's going to shut someone off, or Bortz was saying, oh, give me your radio number, I'll just shut you off right now. That can't be done, but on an internet level, you can literally shut someone off. I'm just exploring the idea of.
I have to ask you: did you order the code red?
Maybe.
Why is this meaningful?
It's meaningful because, as far as our people, generally speaking, have a limited access to the internet in some form or fashion, thus inhibiting their ability to download this fantastic podcast. But also just all of the information, all the things, the commerce elements, education opportunities, etc. Our people are restricted from that because we're frighteningly and high going to recidivate, and the internet is that conduit for you to go capture the 5-year-old. I mean, whatever.
Right, and I see Packingham as vindicating exactly that point, mm-hmm. saying you have a right to access the internet because the internet is where speech happens.
Right.
It is arguably the agora of the modern world. It is the place where people go to share and receive information. And denial of that is, in a very powerful sense, the denial of the right to go to the public square and declaim your opinion and to hear others.
So you may be talking to each other in that marketplace,
yes.
one at a time.
Correct.
But if they say you're not allowed to go to the public square, that's
correct.
A problem.
But
right?
Facebook is a private, it's a publicly held company now. And they have a prohibition against registrants being there.
Which I would just point out is, to my mind, a very separate issue,
mm-hmm.
because that's where property rights and the ability to control come into play,
sure.
in a way that they don't. And that's where your earlier point, I think, about classification of a utility could have a meaningful impact. Because, of course, the distinction is, utilities are required to be accessible by all. You lose the private nature of the property right and interest. And by being declared a utility, you're essentially made public in a meaningful sense that even Facebook has not. And that's perfectly fair.
Mm-hmm. So Facebook would have to be, somebody would have to say, Facebook is now, or something, things
uh-huh.
like Facebook,
yes.
would have to be declared a public utility.
Correct.
Directly.
And I'm not at all clear, and I just don't know.
I don't know
the
whether it could be, but that's what it would take.
I don't think they would be either, but
yeah.
at some point in time, I mean, the utility of Facebook from a political standpoint, same with Twitter, similarly, that all of the politicians are there, that's where they're putting out their issues, that's where your local committees and your civics groups, etc., are all congregating there, and then someone says, hey, you on Facebook, we're talking about this XYZ issue, and sorry, I'm not on Facebook. And now you're taken out of the political conversation.
And that's, I would say that Packingham is significant in that the Supreme Court could have taken the view of the North Carolina Supreme Court that essentially the internet isn't a forum for speech.
Okay.
By recognizing that, the Supreme Court moves the conversation to a position where it's important to discuss what happens when the fora for speech are privately owned, but publicly accessible?
Uh-huh.
That still has to play itself out
sure,
in meaningful
sure.
ways. But I'm not at all sure that you need a declaration that Facebook is the equivalent of a utility in order to challenge Facebook's ability to be selective about who can access it. I don't know the answer,
I know,
but that's a conversation that has to play out.
I had advocated at one time that position myself as a possible argument. I'm not as convinced as when I first advocated it, because there's a significant distinction between what a public utility is. When public utilities, like in the case of, I don't know what the equivalent would be here in Ohio, but in Georgia, you'd have the Georgia Power Company or the Atlanta Gaslight Company. These utilities grew up over decades because it was in the national interest to electrify the country for the betterment of the people, and the companies were a regulated monopoly. In an early era, they've begun to deregulate these monopolies and allow competition where feasible. But it was a national policy to have a regulated monopoly that they would agree to provide service for to everyone in exchange for a guaranteed rate of return. We're going to let you have a rate of return of 9%, 10%, 12%, or whatever the regulating entity. Facebook and the internet has never been designated as a national priority, other than the fact that the early, as best I understand, it was the creation of the universities and some governmental money. But we didn't create the internet to electrify America like we did with publicly owned utilities. So Georgia Power is a publicly owned company owned by shareholders. The Southern Company actually owns Georgia Power. And the Georgia Public Regulation Commission, Public Service Commission, I believe they call it, regulates that company and allows them a rate of return in exchange for their commitment to provide quality, reliable service to everyone within their service territory. We don't have the exact same comparison or anything actually approximating the same comparison with the internet, at least in my ability to analyze and understand the internet. So
we've been running for about almost an hour, 50 minutes, and I want to thank everybody for hanging out, especially Paul. Appreciate your time. I know it's late.
Thank you.
Andy, thank you for the drinks.
You're very welcome. I'm happy to oblige.
I didn't get one.
Did. Well, thank you to our Patreon members for that. It was greatly appreciated.
I think we advised everyone at the beginning that there would be drinking during
this
podcast.
They did. Yes,
and
we
I
did.
Never drink and podcast at the same time. It's not a good combination. Thanks, guys, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye.